accession number 20966, Reel 3.
Janosz Karpiszy, Reel 3.
It was an offense to listen to Western radio. And later on it was it attracted a death penalty if you were caught listening, but we put our ears very close to the loudspeaker, and the BBC did a great job of keeping us in hope. And it was I remember when the first bombing occurred, and we knew that it was American or Allied bombing that happened. Everybody was very pleased. Certainly, our close circle of friends. The attitude towards the Russian or the Soviet army or Soviet occupation was less enthusiastic, I remember. And I think that the best way to characterize the attitude was a fear of the East and an attraction to the West, culturally as well as socially. And the news about the exploits of the Soviet occupying forces and the expectation how an American or English, British force would behave, or a French force would behave, was quite different.
Now, can we go through the period, please, step by step, from 15th of October to January 45?
Yes.
As far as it affected you, in as much detail as you can recollect, please.
Yes. I think I have to mention two families, both connected to my father's occupation. My father's secretary at the security firm was the daughter of a war widow, and she had a sister who was a nursery nurse, and this family by the name of Toth, T-O-T-H, were extremely grateful for my father, because the education of these war orphans, and I think that the mother was also employed, but I don't remember in what way, with the help of my father, was one such family who really regained their dignity after the war, because the work of my father created the opportunity for the girls to go to school and for the mother to earn a living and help with the schooling of the girls. She was a great lady. My father's secretary and the nursery nurse lady, and she brought the information that we should leave the house on the 15th of October, and she arranged where to go, and that was the very modest home of an employee of my father, who was a war veteran, injured, and he had a maimed, both hands were maimed, but he could still use it, who was a security guard in the firm, of which my father was a managing director. And this man was a lovely man because he often came to us and helped in the garden and helped chopping up the firewood, which I did with him. But he was a habitual drinker. So much so that often, at the beginning, when he had his wages, by the time he got home, there were no wages because he went on a drinking spree for days and then drank it all away. And my father made arrangements that the wages were paid to the wife, who had four or five children. I might remember later on, because it's important, the family was an important family. We went to their home, and we were put in a room which was a box room in their very modest Vajog is the Hungarian name. They built houses out of mud, mud bricks. That was the sort of house they lived in. In Újpest also, which had no windows. And they fed us in there. We stayed there for about 4 or 5 weeks. We had buckets for toilets, and these people were sort of carrying out the buckets and bringing them back clean. And sometime in the middle of November, 4 or 5 weeks later, they brought us false papers, and we became refugees from Transylvania, and we went on the tram and went to Budapest, and we went to a house, the address I remember, 25 Koltói Anna Utca, near the Telaki tér, which was a flea market, where one of the sons of this couple, the name is Seregi, was the concierge in a big block of flats, and they obtained a room for us, which was sublet by one of the inhabitants in the block of flats. And we moved there sometimes the 20th of November or thereabout. And we spent the rest of the siege of Budapest in that house. The name of the lady whose flat we went into was Berta Puherna. I don't know why I remember that name, because it's a funny name. And the house had cellars, which we used on air raids to start with. But from early December, the Russians virtually, the Soviet army virtually surrounded Budapest. And one evening, my mother said that everything is, the fighting is so close and they are shelling, that from now on, I am not going to sleep upstairs on the second floor. I will just sleep and settle in like many others in the house, in the cellar. And my father didn't want to come down. I don't know why. He had a fear of living underneath a house, I suppose. But he came down also. And that night, a shell came through the wall of the flat where we slept and made matchsticks out of the bed in which my parents slept, and almost matchsticks of the divan on which I slept in front of the at the foot of the bed. So we never came up anymore. And soon, in January, there was street fighting in the street, which took a couple of weeks. And it was like a pendulum. It swung. Sometimes we saw Soviet soldiers. Sometimes they came down to the cellar and looked for men. Sometimes they were the Germans. And so it was a seesaw situation for 2 or 3 weeks. Until at the end of 24th of January, things became quieter, and the Soviet army took firm control over the area. There was one day when, for example, must have been around the 21st or 22nd of January even, when we had 2 days, for 2 days, which was unusual, the Soviet army there, and we thought everything was now settled. And there was a roll call. All the men had to go upstairs, up onto the yard. They said, everybody from 16 upwards. And I went there, and my mother was pleading me, don't go. But 45, I was just about 16, and I was very proud that I was about 16, in becoming 16 in April. So I went up there, and all the men were lined up, when suddenly there was tremendous commotion, shooting, and the Germans came back. And the Soviet soldier says, just go back to the cellar, we'll come back for you. And that afternoon there was fighting, tremendous noise, nobody was daring to go upstairs. And then the situation cleared, and they never came back for us. And we were told later, a couple of days later, that in the next house they lined the men up and they took them away, many of whom never returned because they took them to Siberia or somewhere in the Soviet Union to do some work. How did we live? How did we feed ourselves? We had some money. I suppose my parents took some money with them when we left the house in October. But I remember one day my father coming home with a piece of meat, still warm, wrapped in a newspaper or some sort of a paper, which he himself carved out of a horse which was hit by a shell and fell on the road, and people descended upon it. And that's what we ate for lunch or dinner, I don't remember. The importance of that is that my father never passed the shop window of a butcher because he couldn't stand the sight of meat. As far as I can remember, this this was the case, and I suppose this was because of his experiences in the war in 1914, 15, 16. He was wounded in 1916, finally. And yet he provided for his family in this way. The diet was very monotone. I remember, for example, sweet corn, but dried sweet corn being boiled on top of the oven down in the cellar. They set up an oven somehow, let the pipe out the flue through the some opening into onto the street, and everybody was sort of munching boiled dried sweet corn or some potatoes they could find, and meat, like I said before. But it wasn't very varied, but I don't remember hunger. We never went hungry. We craved for some chocolates, I remember, or something like that. But I don't remember hunger at the time. So these two families, the Sheregi and the Tot family, became very important symbols in my life of humanity and goodwill. We kept in touch with both of them all throughout the remainder of our lives. And after 57, when 56 really, when we left the country, my wife and I, unfortunately, by now, the contact is lost because the parents and the sons, some of them, most of them are dead, and their children is a different generation, and the contact has been lost, but the memory is there.
What happened to the family next?
We went back to the house, as I said, on the 24th of January. We walked back from Budapest, this is more or less the center of Budapest, to our suburb, found the house empty. But somehow we got some mattresses and we were able to sleep in the house. Luckily, the heating was still functioning, so we could light the fire and heat the house. I think our first food was from the landlady from the pub next door, across the road. We lived like everybody else, except we did not really have a household. We didn't even have pots and pans or forks and knives in the kitchen. We just about had a change of underwear or whatever. And gradually, we sort of re-established a house which was very, very strange to be in it, with the furniture gone, and some of it was found later, I don't know how and where, but not all of it. All the ornaments disappeared completely, so we had to start a life again. And I remember that in 1945 there was a very short school year, because of course from October the schools were closed. I was still going to school in to the gymnasium in September, but the year had to be finished somehow, and there was an attempt on the part of the government to make sure that no student loses a year, an academic year. And the school year started in April, late April, May, June, July, and there was only 1 month summer holiday, August, and September the next year started. So the whole year's material had to be dealt with, the curriculum, in 3 months, perhaps. Now what happened to me is that gradually the odd person was sort of drifting back from concentration camps, from forced labor camps, and diagonally opposite to us lived a family where there were two sons, one of them my brother's age and the other slightly older, returned one night and they found somebody else in their house. They lived in a bungalow. And they came over because they saw there was life in the house, and we knew them quite well before. And they said, "Oh, what shall we do? Where shall we go?" And my mother said, "Of course, you will sleep in our house. But we have some blankets and things we can get together, because we didn't have proper beds even then. But the way you look, I'd like you to undress outside the house, come in and have a bath, and we shall throw away your dresses, clothing you have, and we somehow get you some underwear and shirts and trousers and whatever." And my mother went round the neighborhood and got something together. They had the bath, and they stayed with us for 2 nights. And then they sorted out there, they could get one room back in their own bungalow. And that was that. And a couple of weeks later, I fell ill. I had a temperature for 1 day, very high, and the next day it was all right. The day after, a temperature again, and it was all right again. And it went on like that for a week. And the doctor came, and they couldn't imagine what was wrong with me. And then the police appeared and said, "Did we have two men staying in the house?" And my mother said, "Yes." "Why?" "Because," they said, "and is there anybody ill in the house?" And my mother said, "Yes, my son is showing some symptoms, but we don't know what's wrong with him." And they said, "Because the two men are now in hospital, in isolation hospital, because they have typhus." And my mother said, "Oh dear." And then the chief district health officer came, the doctor, and examined me, and eventually perhaps in a day, they diagnosed that I also have typhus. Not typhoid, but typhus. They said, "I have to go to hospital." And my mother said, "No, I am not allowing him to go to hospital. I shall take care of him." And so they put a red label on the house. There was a quarantine, no way out or in of the house. And I became very ill, and meanwhile the school year started, and I wasn't there. My condition got worse and worse, and the course of the illness was sort of a typical textbook case, that you have this swinging temperature. And after a while, and it gets worse and worse and worse, and then you probably, one probably loses conscience, and one is delirious because of the high temperature, and I was out of this world for 3.5 days, and I pulled through with the help of my mother and with the help of the doctors, who gave me the best available medication, the best possible medication in those terrible circumstances after the war. Well, the war was still virtually going on elsewhere. I was off school for 7 weeks. I lost a lot of weight. I couldn't walk when the temperature went down, and I had to learn to walk. And my memory suffered. Ever since, I am making lists of my, you know, itinerary or my various jobs that I have to do, because I don't keep them in mind. Otherwise, my memory is not affected. Only in keeping the agenda that is there for the day. And I went back to school eventually, where I spent about 5 weeks, five last weeks, and I had a struggle to pass the exams, which I did with top marks at the end of the year, so I could carry on into the next year in September. My father went back to the security firm, but because of new war veterans, the whole institution was disrupted and more or less disbanded, and there was no more opportunity for him in that area. So sometime in 1940, late 45 or 46, he opened what is called there a traffic, which is a tobacco shop, a little corner. In fact, there was a little purpose built, little building in the corner of a street, and that's how he earned his living after that. And my mother became a clerk in that was much later, not in 47, but not in 45, but probably 48, after the communist takeover, where all the houses, blocks of flats, were nationalized, and they set up a national house agency, and my mother was a clerk in that organization. And in the communist regime, everybody had to work, so that's why both my mother and father were working. And life wasn't so easy. I matriculated in 1947, and I went to university, and I became an electronic engineer. I graduated in 1951.
Had that been your choice, to go into that line?
Yes, my second choice. I wanted to become a musician. But my mother said to me, and